Hey, this is This Week in Self-Hosted. I'm your host, Ethan. This week, I am joined by guest co-host Philip, the developer of the self-hosted documentation slash wiki platform DocMost. Philip, I am super excited to have you on this week. I know DocMost is relatively new in the grand scheme of self-hosted software, and I feel like it made a really big splash this year when you launched it. I know I've been really into it. The community's been into it. Every time I see someone talk about it or you bring it up, people are excited about what you're building and what's coming down the pipeline. We're going to get a little, we're going to have an opportunity to chat about DocMost throughout the newsletter as we go through the newsletter during this episode. So I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time chatting about it now. I do want to jump right into things with the newsletter. I know we both have some things queued up that we'd like to talk about this week. The emphasis, I think, where we'll probably spend a lot or most of our time is actually in new software launches this week.
Yeah,
I think I've had like a record amount that I've had since I've been publishing the newsletter. As of the time we're recording this, there are 27 new software launches this week, which is really big and a lot of software. So I'm anxious to talk about that. But with that being said, I do want to pivot into the news quickly. We're going to chat about a couple of things that popped up this week in the news for self-hosted in the self-hosted world, and then we'll jump into software updates and new software. Sound good?
All right, that's good, and I'm excited to be here.
Oh, perfect. So a couple big things in the news. I've jotted a couple things down here, but two things I really want to talk about. OpenSense users, if you're not familiar, OpenSense is an open source firewall. For those who want to self-host that and aren't happy with maybe the software that their ISP-provided router provides them, a popular alternative would be pfSense, which is probably more popular than OpenSense. Released some big updates this week, and notably, they released essentially, I don't want to say native support for Tailscale plugin because it's community-supported, but there's a built-in way for people to use Tailscale within OpenSense, which is big. I think people have been able to do it before, but it's not as easy as it is to spin up some of the other plugins and features OpenSense has. So it's been really exciting to see that. And Philip, I'm sure that's probably something you've come across with DocMost, because Tailscale is always a big conversation that comes up when people are trying to figure out how they access things externally. And so obviously a VPN or something like Tailscale is a really big aspect of that. So has there been a lot of conversation around DocMost when it comes to things like that?
People use a few similar software, and you know, sometimes they have issues accessing their wiki. Well, we've not had any one about Tailscale yet.
Got it. I feel like that might be a little frustrating for you to have to help people troubleshoot stuff like that, when in reality, it probably doesn't have a whole lot to do with DocMost anyway. But in related OpenSense news, and I do want to spend this on DocMost a little bit, I know we were having an interesting conversation before we started recording. OpenSense is also working on a logo redesign. So I don't know how old their current logo is right now, but they're slowly rolling out another logo that's been resurfacing kind of across their platforms. I think if you go on the homepage, it's not there yet. I think would be from the forums is where this is coming from, or no, this is from the actual web interface of OpenSense itself. I like the logo better than I do the old logo. I can't tell you why, but logos are just something that always fascinate me. And I know you and I have talked about the DocMost logo before, because I actually had some issues finding it when I was trying to add it to my icon collection. So one, how did you come up with your logo? And two, are you happy with your logo?
That's a tricky question. So the logo, before I launched DocMost Republic, you know, I was looking to get out something real fast. And then I hit up my friend Desire, and I asked him to help me come up with a few things. And he came up with some options, and I decided to go with that. But I was like, I don't have time to give my input about this logo yet, but I'm happy to run with it, and eventually we are going to review. So since then, I've not been able to, you know, go back to it because I've been busy working on other important stuff.
Got it. So for what it's worth, I think DocMost has a great logo. I don't dislike it. And I don't look at it and think, oh, that's something someone just slapped together quickly because they needed something. It was evident when I reached out to you, you didn't have a high-res version of your logo. That had me questioning. I was like, why does he not have something like that? But that makes sense. So I'll be anxious and hope I hear from you if and when that logo does change at some point in the future. I'll say I'm not a graphic designer, so please don't look to me for any input on how maybe that should look.
Yeah, if people use it a lot, then it might just be the logo.
Yeah, you might actually be stuck with it. That's a really good point. People have started associating it with DocMost now, so maybe you can't deviate much. But you have like the D going on there, so maybe no, I'm just going to pull it up for people who aren't familiar with it. So maybe you have something special there with just the stylization of the D. So maybe as the logo evolves, you just kind of slowly build on something like that to retain any recognition you might have built up until now.
Yeah.
But anyway, the last thing I want to talk about in the news, Home Assistant had a couple things going on this week. First off, they released or opened their annual user survey where they collect feedback from across the community and people who are using and developing Home Assistant and its various integrations. That's open through January 20th. So if you're listening to this and you're a Home Assistant user, I would encourage you to click the link in the newsletter, fill out that survey, provide your input. I'm sure they use it and find it super helpful. But perhaps a little more exciting than that is they also released some new hardware this week, which something that happens more and more frequently with Home Assistant. People don't always think of them as a hardware company, but they and their parent company, Nabucasa, have slowly started building their own kind of collection of hardware to help people get into self-hosting. And this week they launched their new voice hardware. They've put a lot of emphasis last year too on voice assistance and being able to control your smart home and automations with the voice. And so just this week, they announced their the hardware that they're going to be using to kick off that that initiative there. I personally think it looks really cool. I had the opportunity to interview Paulus from Home Assistant earlier this year, and he gave me a glimpse of this hardware, and I thought it looked really cool in the when he was showing me it just really quickly on the webcam. And it does look a lot cooler than even it did then when I look at the pictures here. So I ordered it immediately. It is actually available for sale now. So if anyone's listening and wants to purchase this, it is out there. You can go out to one of their three retailers, buy it. I have no idea what the actual shipping time is. I didn't get that on my order myself, but I'm anxious to see how it works and to see how I can further frustrate my family members with aspects of my smart home and home automation that occasionally don't work. And as a result, my lights don't turn on. So with that being said, I'm going to pivot in software updates. Philip, I'm going to let you kick this off. I know you have one or two updates that stuck out to you this week as you were going through the newsletter. You want to walk us through those?
Okay. So one of the updates that caught my attention was PhoneBricks 3.0. So I did see they removed a couple of features from the open source version. And here's what I think. So I think when it comes to software, especially open source software, you know, users have expectation. And one of the features they removed was the SSO. And funny enough, a few days back, I've been on their website and documentation, and I saw the list of features, and I'm like, oh, this is a cool software. And I like the stack design, like the stack of cards design and their survey forms. And so seeing this update, you know, kind of coincides with what I've been checking the past few days. So when it comes to SSO, I feel in open source software, developers see it as a means to, you know, to generate revenue for the product. And for me personally, I gave it a lot of thought because I don't want to implement features and then remove them eventually. So I feel users are not going to take this really well, because it's one thing to use of a software and then you have expectations and features you depend on, and then updating to the next version, you don't have those features anymore. And things like SSO, I believe lots of users are going to get stuck trying to, you know, continue the same workflow they are used to. So for me, I think developers should be more careful with the features they introduce and be more thoughtful about it so that they don't get to remove them in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if anyone's not familiar with PhoneBricks, it's a really great self-hosted survey and form platform. And so obviously it's one of those applications that spans both community and enterprise uses and use case purposes. Obviously, a lot of companies and businesses have a need for software like this. And so they, as Philip mentioned, in their 3.0 release this week, they actually revoked SSO support in the community edition, which to your point, Philip, is really controversial for a lot of people, because a lot of self-hosters just have this deep desire for everything to have SSO integration. Yeah. And rightfully so, it makes things easier. but to your point, developers also need to make a living. And often it is, I think, one of the ways developers resort to getting some of that support or making or financially getting that support that they need to continue developing, because it's not one of those features that's necessarily essential to the functionality of the software, right?
Yeah.
The Formbricks application, DocMost, they work the same whether or not you have SSO or not. It's just about how are you managing user accounts outside of that? And what's the complexity of users having multiple accounts across multiple applications? Something you said I thought was really interesting, actually, was it's like one thing to not provide the community edition with single sign-on capabilities, but it's also another thing to provide it and then take it back at some point. And I can see there being some pushback for this, to your point as well, that there are probably people who've deployed this and are utilizing SSO for this and want all the capabilities that are being delivered with 3.0 and are going to have to come to the decision of, do we not upgrade and keep SSO, or do we upgrade and just lose it and just figure out, can we have like a clean migration? And then, you know, are users okay with not having that? How, if you're comfortable talking about it, how are you approaching that with DocMost? I remember seeing some conversations on the DocMost repository about single sign-on. Have you given that a whole lot of thought yet?
Yeah, when I made the project public a few months back, you know, someone created an issue asking for SSO and OIDC. So my reply on the thread was I needed more time to think about it, to consider it, because I don't want the situation where I commit to certain features too soon and then I realize, oh, I shouldn't have done that. So I feel it's important to set it out straight and give users what to expect. And eventually I told them that SSO is something I consider to be part of the commercial offering. So this way I don't have to, you know, do what people will always love, but eventually I have to create the balance between features that belongs to the paid or the open source offering. So for me, I've decided to put it on the paid offering, and, you know, I have to think of it, you know, so I don't have to put it and then remove it eventually, even if it makes some people not so happy.
Yeah, I really appreciate that approach. I think that's really thoughtful. I have to say I'm in a weird situation where I understand why the community wants single sign-on, and I understand the whole SSO tax and all the stuff people document about software that does it. But at the same time, I understand why people leverage it as a way to maybe push people to Enterprise Edition. You know, you're from a DocMost perspective, I'm sure you're putting a ton of time into developing it. And so if you're not getting the contributions you need to continue development, I think it's a fair way to approach that and say, hey, you know, here's some features that maybe won't impact the actual way you use DocMost, but just have some other maybe impacts that are slightly unrelated. So that's always a tricky topic. And it's actually a good lead into one of the software updates I wanted to chat about a little bit this week.
Yeah.
There is a relatively newer application out there called Maybe. It's a budgeting application. And I feel like it was in beta for the longest time. And just recently they had like an actual release version that they encouraged people to download. And it's right out of the gate. It's a very well-developed, it looks great. Everything about it just looks really appealing. Personal like budgeting and finance app. But I saw in their update this week, they've added Plaid integration, which is huge for any budgeting application, because I think one of the biggest hurdles for people when they manage their budgets is getting all of their spending into a single place, because they might use their debit card or their credit card, or some people like to pay things in cash. And so I think it's harder for people to track when they have to manually bring things together. And so bank sync is huge, and Plaid integration is really big for adoption. But I've noticed they made a call out in their release notes about self-hosting Plaid. And I think I like this approach too. The hosted version completely supports Plaid, and they will support it if people have issues. The approach they're taking with the self-hosted version of Maybe is that they're encouraging people to configure it. They've provided some examples as how people can set it up with all the requirements people need to make that integration, but they're just not going to officially support it. So if people need help troubleshooting, they might not get timely responses or anything like that. I thought that was a really interesting way of saying, hey, you know, here's something complex we provided. It's a good way for people to consider supporting us while getting the benefit of an open source project. But also, you know, it's still here if you want to self-host it and you want the functionality and you don't want to pay for the hosted version.
Yeah. So. And I think most financial APIs are usually expensive and might not be feasible for most self-hosters.
Yeah, and there aren't many. And they're expensive because they're so secure, because it's so hard to come up with something that speaks with financial institutions in a way that's secure and that people don't have to be nervous that their data is being compromised at any point along the way.
Yeah, absolutely.
So with that being said, want to pivot into new software. I know we both have a couple queued up that we're going to chat about. As I mentioned earlier, we have 27 new software launches this week, which is just huge. I feel like every day I've been adding a handful. And it's constantly like, when is this going to stop? I feel like I almost have too many at this point, but I don't think that's possible. And it is a combination of like, some of them are scripts. Some of them are actual applications that have a web interface. Some of them are VPNs for accessing things remotely. So again, maybe not an application in like the traditional sense. A lot of cool things here. And a lot of creative things. CityBot 2, you design and create social media posts that are catered to local areas. That's something I've never seen before. There's another Jellyfin Music client for Mac OS that I always love seeing them pop up. I know Jellyfin has its own official clients for people who are streaming media, but I think people have come up and developed some really cool applications for it. Gift Goose is a random pairing tool for gift giving. If you're having like a white elephant exchange or trying to come up with a way to like divvy up the office pool or whatever. It's a tool you can use to pair people up for gifts. With that being said, two I wanted to specifically focus on. There's this one called Local Content Share. And at its core, it's not super complex. I will say I like the design of it. If you've listened to previous episodes, you know I love well-designed applications. I love DocMos, by the way. I think DocMos looks really great. The Local Content Share is another one of those platforms. I feel like they pop up fairly occasionally for easily sharing files and content with other devices on a local network. And so the idea is like, if you have people over at your house and you want to share something with them, rather than having to figure out how you can text everyone something, you can go to this application, you pop in the URL and share the content that way. And then anyone else who's on your network can also go there and see the content that's being shared. And it's a really easy way to distribute it. And so this one just stuck out to me. Again, I like the design of it. It's very simple to self-host and deploy. So it'd be interesting to see this evolve. I know Apple has their own unique take on it, and that's kind of dominated the space. So it's really cool to see other people try and tackle that and make it something that's bigger than just a single platform.
Yeah.
And the second thing I wanted to talk about, and then I'll pass it over to you, Philip, is an application called TextBee. And it's really interesting. And this popped up in the last day or two, and I've been following it closely. A lot of the discourse, I've seen people talking about it. It's an SMS or texting gateway where you can actually allow users or configure it so users can send text messages from the web interface or from a web application for that use an API, and you can use it for notifications, alerts, to communicate things with. which I think is really novel because there are a lot of notification platforms out there, both hosted and self-hosted. And they all have their unique take on how they deliver notifications. But there's not a whole lot that gets into text and SMS messages. And so this is really interesting. A lot of the interesting discourse and dialogue I saw surrounding it was some carriers can be pretty strict with, you know, the rate at which you send messages or how many you send in a single period of time. And so I think with everything, there is a bit of a disclaimer. Just be aware of what your carrier's expectations are when it comes to delivering text messages, because this does seem like it might be ripe for abuse and people should be aware of that. But again, just something novel, not something I see pop up very often. So I found that worth calling out. That being said, Philip, I'm going to pass it over to you. Chat a little bit about some of the ones that stuck out to you.
Yeah, so one of the ones I came across was GitHub Start Semantic Search. I found it on Hacker News a few days back. So I did go through the repo and I looked at the source code. So it's pretty interesting. So I found that they fetch your GitHub repos and then they take the embeddings and send it to OpenAI and then get the store it in the database and then you can search for it. So personally, I have about 2,800 stars on GitHub. I mean, 2,800 projects I start on GitHub.
Oh my gosh. So
sometimes I forget the names of projects. So something like this is going to be useful to, you know, try to recall some project if I remember what they do, but don't get the name. And I think it's pretty interesting. And I tried it out. I had to generate my own GitHub token and then open AI keys. And it looks pretty interesting. Something I would love to try out eventually.
Yeah, so the idea is, and by the way, 2,800 stars is a lot of stars, at least for me.
Charlie, sorry to cut you. I start more things on GitHub than I like posts on social media.
Oh, I love that. I was going to say, I think in totality, the amount of repos I've come across, I'm not even sure if it amounts to 2,800. That's a lot of repositories. But so it sounds like the way this works, I have not spun this up myself, is you plug in your GitHub token so it can access your starred repositories. And then it also uses OpenAI or AI search to enhance its search capabilities. So you don't necessarily have to remember the exact name of the repository or project. As long as you can kind of remember what it did, that's enough for you to type in the search box here and then have it find for you.
Exactly.
Did it seem like it worked pretty well when you didn't have the name of something and just typed in a description of what you were looking for?
Yeah, it's worked. I tried it a few times, but I think the indexing is kind of cumbersome because it has to index about 50 repositories at the time. So you have to click on fetch more repositories. And I have got like 2,800. So it was, I did it up to 300 and I just stopped because I feel if they kind of do automatic pagination, it's going to be best and easier.
Yeah. So I guess you just really have to be descriptive enough that you hope it gets it within the first 20 or 30
exactly.
search results when they pop up. It's funny. At first, when I first came across this, I was like, why not just Google what you were looking for? Like GitHub repo, this and that. But I actually know from experience that does not work well. There are just so many repositories on GitHub and so many similarly named repositories. You know, I see like, I don't know, in the newsletter, I probably cover anywhere from like 50 to 60 projects a week. Yeah. Some of them overlap from week to week. It's not always unique. But even in just that small sample, I constantly see projects that have the same exact name.
Yeah.
And that's just like a small subset of repositories. That's self-hosted software. And there's so much more on GitHub. And so I can see how this would actually be super helpful. So I'm glad you called that out.
Yeah, thank you.
Anything else?
Yeah, and I saw this Strava statistics. I think it's an interesting one because I use Strava personally. I've got a bike and when I start riding, I use Strava to track my movement. But one thing I feel about Strava is the analytics on the in-app and the app is not too good. It's very basic. So I feel something like this is going to be useful for me if I want to see my data over time. But one caveat is it's only support biking. So that works for me, but for many people who run or do other kind of activities, it may not be useful for them at this point. But I'm sure it's still under development, so eventually the developers will get to it.
Okay. So do you think the capability is there, they just haven't gotten around to it? Yeah, to support more than just cycling?
I saw somewhere on the README, they talked about it only supporting biking for now, and there's a request for another activities. So, I mean, it means they are actually actively working on it. So eventually, I don't know if they've got some technical limitations or something, or perhaps it's more about, okay, start with something that's popular, and over time, you know, if there's interest, we add more.
Okay, yeah, I see that here, actually. It's just right above the screenshots I was at, that they have an open issue to start supporting runs as well. It's really interesting. When I saw this, I thought, oh, this is just kind of another one of those applications that people just want control of their data and the privacy that comes along with that. I didn't realize it was also one of those things where what Strava provides just isn't good enough from like a statistical analysis perspective. And so you being able to ingest your own data means you can slice and dice it and look at it different ways than you're given in the app. And I think that's really cool. It does look here. I see under the things to consider header as we've been chatting, that it looks like there is an API rate limit for people who are just starting out with this. So if you spin this up, and maybe if you're a longtime Strava user, you should probably just expect to be a little patient with the rate at which it imports some of your data, based on the fact that the developer is trying to respect some of the rate limits that the developers impose on people who are using this data and the API. But yeah, this is a really cool application. I'm glad you called that out. I would encourage everyone else to check some of the other things out. A lot of them are kind of like amateur developed applications. There are other things in here though. Speaking of GitHub, there's another one. I was trying to remember what the name was as you were talking about the semantic search for GitHub. There's a My GitHub 2024, which is a year, kind of like the Strava thing we just talked about, but with GitHub statistics. So if you're looking for that, I remember seeing this and thinking like, why did they cater this to just 2024? Like, why not keep it generic as something people can use every single year? But I don't know, maybe there's something specific that they need to change from year to year. I also saw for people who are Proxmox users, Proxmox dropped the alpha release of their data center manager this week, which I used to be a Proxmox user. I have not anymore. I did not realize this was in the works, but it looks like it's a central place to manage some of the machines, nodes, and clusters that people have spun up. So if you are the type of person who loves signing up for alpha releases and you are just yearning for this functionality from Proxmox, it is here. And I'd encourage you check it out. I've linked it to a forum post. I couldn't find anything more concrete than that when I was compiling the newsletter. So check that out. Last thing I want to talk through in the non-new software that I discovered this week, I have an application or a directory of self-hosted applications that I maintain for people to browse and for discovery. I have used a platform in the past called AdMiner, which I think is very well known. It's essentially like a web interface for databases and managing them. You can perform queries, you can import, export, do a million different things. It's just a way to manage your databases if you don't want to do it from the command line. But AdMiner as a project has not been maintained. I think on the repository, I was just looking at it today. It's been 3 or 4 years, I think, since there have been any commits or anything. And so I found this project called AdMiner Evo, which I assume is just AdMiner Evolution, which is kind of like the spiritual successor to AdMiner. It's very clearly just a group of community members who are avid AdMiner users, recognize that it hadn't been developed recently. And so they took it on themselves to, again, this is the beauty of open source projects, to take the project, fork it, to put their own spin on it, and they've been updating it. It doesn't look that the releases themselves have been frequent, but their commit activity has been. So there hasn't been a release since April, but there's a commit as recent as last month. So rest assured, it's alive and well, and the team is definitely working on that. I will definitely be spinning it up this weekend because I really like AdMiner, but I've recognized that that's hasn't been developed actively. So if you're also looking for something like that, definitely give it a spin and give it a look. So with that being said, Philip, I am going to stop it here. We just hit the magical 30-minute mark here. So I think that's a good stopping point. I know I've talked a lot, but I'm so grateful that you've joined me again. I'm excited about DocMost. I know the community is excited about DocMost. I think it's really cool to kind of get you and your name out there and to hear people talk a little bit about the rationale behind the decisions you've made with DocMost. If people want to connect with you outside of this episode, what would be the best way for them to be able to do that?
I've got a Twitter account at PhilipOfficial9 and then GitHub, because I'm more active on GitHub than other social media. So you can find me on GitHub and Twitter, PhilipOfficial9.
Okay, cool. And for anyone who's interested in that, I will also include those links in the video description or the podcast description, depending on how you're listening to this. But again, Philip, thanks a bunch for joining me. This is great. I'd love to have you on in the future. If there are any big DocMost updates, I'd love to talk through those with you and give you a chance to show them off to the rest of the community as well. But thanks again. And to everyone listening, thank you so much. Have a great weekend and happy self-hosting.
Thank you. Bye-bye.